And welcome back. It's midday. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, nearly 6 out of 10 Americans believe that there's a need for strong political parties other than Democrats and Republicans. But third-party candidates face a daunting road when they pursue public office. Tomorrow, we're going to discuss the viability of third parties in American politics with three candidates who are on the ballot in November. Libertarian David Lasher is running for Congress. Ian Schlockman is the Green Party candidate for governor. And Neil Simon is an independent running for the United States Senate. So that's coming up tomorrow on Midday. They'll be here. That's all part of our series of conversations with the candidates. And by the way, a reminder that the one and only debate in the governor's race takes place tonight at 7 o'clock. WIPR will simulcast the debate between Governor Larry Hogan and former NAACP President Ben Jealous. Now it's time for another installment of What You Got Cooking.
Say hey, good looking. What you got cooking? How's about cooking something up with me?
Chef John Shields joins me. He is an author and the owner of Gertrude's Restaurant at the Baltimore Museum of Art. He's also the host of Coastal Cooking and Chesapeake Bay Cooking on Maryland Public Television and PBS. And as we mentioned, he's got a great new book. It's called The New Chesapeake Kitchen. How are you doing, John?
I am doing great, Tom. Thank you.
And thank you for your generosity, you and your publisher, Johns Hopkins University Press. As we mentioned, if you make a pledge to WIPR to become a member during this hour, you will get a free copy of The New Chesapeake Kitchen for as long as supplies last. So this is a beautiful book. It's beautifully written. It's beautifully photographed. And of course, the recipes just seem as mouthwatering as ever. What was your aspiration to write? As you mentioned, this is your fourth one.
It is.
So you've been to this rodeo before.
Yeah. This is actually the fourth and last on the Chesapeake Bay Cooking line.
And why? What did you want to explore that you hadn't explored in the other books?
Well, okay. So I look at this, and this is not morose, Tom. This is. I look at this as my culinary last will and testament to the Chesapeake. I've been doing this for 30 some years, writing about the Bay, cooking everything from the Bay, and so after all that time, you know, I had some thoughts and some ideas about how the Chesapeake cuisine started, how it's evolved. And then I wanted to try to imagine what would be a kitchen like in the 21st century. How are we going to cook? How is it going to be different than it was in the 18th century, the 19th century? And so that's kind of how this book came to being.
And only by knowing what's happened before can we have a full appreciation and understanding of what we're doing now and where we might head in terms of cooking techniques and the kind of stuff we eat. You make the point about eating food that is both Bay and body friendly, and you can do both.
Yeah, absolutely can. You know, we always have to look at where the food's coming from, how it's produced, and then, you know, I loved Michael Pollan's books. I read all of them. I was a great fan. And I loved the whole idea of eat food, and I say real food, not too much, and mostly plants. And I think it's a kind of a way that we've cooked for thousands of years. You know, if you look at most civilizations, that's how they cooked. And so, you know, when we're doing that here, I just look at some of the precious protein that we have, whether it be the crab or the rockfish, and we only have so much. I mean, let's get real. We only have so much in the Bay, but we don't want to give it up. That's part of our culture. So I'm looking at recipes that kind of stretch that protein, that we can still know where we're located, but let's look at some recipes that put them together and stretch it out a little bit. And again, it's the way that we've always cooked, really.
John Shields, the new book is called The New Chesapeake Kitchen. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number to call midday to talk to John Shields about Chesapeake cooking is different than the pledge number. To pledge your support for WIPR, that's 410-235-1395. To reach us here at midday to talk talk to John Shields with your favorite recipes, your favorite techniques, your favorite memories of a childhood, perhaps, that was, premised in Chesapeake Bay cooking. Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or drop us an email at midday@WYPR. Send us a tweet, and you can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. And John, you make the point that so many more people are living now in the Chesapeake watershed. The population has soared, and this, of course, has put a huge stress on the environment and the bay itself. And things are different than they were in the 1700s and the 1800s, but there were also things that, you know, that farmers did back in those days and fishermen did it back in those days that have led to some of the deficits that we're currently dealing with.
Absolutely. In the 1800s, they had the great oyster wars. So there were ships going up and down the bay, shooting at each other to haul in as many oysters as they could, because it always seemed that there was no end. You know, there's just no end to this. And then we got to a point where, the harvests were about 5% of the historic levels of the old days. We were getting a little low on supplies there. And some of that is human consumption. Some of it comes from environmental factors. When you have a whole bunch of people in one area and it gets more and more crowded, some of the ways that we live and we behave, it actually impacts the food, right?
Sure does.
And we've seen so many changes. In the old days, we had oysters galore, crabs galore, and we have a little less of that now. But we have some invasive species. And so we could be scared of them and hide in rooms. But I think we should embrace some of those, and I think we can eat our way to a cleaner bay.
One of the points you make, and I couldn't agree with it more, of course, you are a frequent flyer to the Waverly Farmers Market on Saturdays. You are a fixture there and have been for a long time. My farmers market of choice is the one under the JFX on Sunday mornings. But I have so enjoyed over the years getting to know by name, because I have conversations with them every week during the time that the market's open, the farmers who are growing the food that I'm buying. Right. So I talked to Tommy McCarthy about the wonderful beans, and he's at the Waverly Farmers Market as well. The lima beans, the navy beans, the black beans that he buys or that he grows. I talked to my friend Jim about the string beans. I talked to Joe Bartenfelder, who happens to be the Secretary of Agriculture, about the corn that he grows and stuff, and I get it from them every week. It makes a difference when you're cooking and you're using food that people friends are growing.
It does, doesn't it? I mean, to have that connection is just amazing. I mean, it really is. I mean, I know growing up, my grandma and a lot of them, they all had farmer relatives or farmer friends, so they already automatically had that connection. But now for us to be able to go to these ever-growing number of farmers markets and having the connection and talking to them about, their lives, how the weather's affecting them, their children going to school and graduating. These are people, and they have families and they have lives, and everything that they do on the land affects them and affects us. And so I have much more confidence. I feel much better about my food and how it's grown knowing these people. I really do.
Absolutely. It makes a big difference. You talk about invasive species, and you do a little bit of making lemonade out of lemons with some of them in this book. There's a recipe you have for blue cat seafood hash, which is interesting because this is the blue catfish.
Yeah.
And there are folks who would like to see a lot fewer blue catfish lying around the bay than there are, but given the fact that they're here, they're considered an invasive species. But you can make something good out of this.
You sure can. Now, the blue catfish was a species that was introduced in Virginia by sports fishermen 20, 30 years ago. The problem with that was they don't have any natural predators, and they're quite prolific. So at this point, the southern parts of the bay, they take up about 70% of the biomass of the waters of the bay. Wow. That's a lot.
That's a whole lot, isn't it? Yeah.
And they love little crabs. They love little rockfish. And again, they have no predators. So we are now preying on them. There were some women down in D.C. That were involved with feeding the homeless that read about this. And they went to fishermen, watermen all through Virginia and Maryland and said, hey, if we could find you two wholesalers and you sold that catfish, could you sell them as much as you catch? And so they all agreed. And this became the Wide Net Project. And so now restaurants, seafood stores, fishmongers can get this catfish. And it's really good because it's a little different than the native species because they're not bottom feeders. So you don't get that kind of muddy, murky thing where you have to kind of soak them in milk before you use them. Beautiful flavor, really clean, wonderful texture.
And for once, plentiful.
Plentiful. Now, the little caveat to that is that they grow up to about 150 pounds. Now, this is why.
Bring your big pan.
Big old catfish. But we can really only use them if they're 20 pounds or less. Mm-hmm. Because when they live in the bay that long, they really pick up a lot of mercury and PCBs. So you can only use the smaller fish. The other fish, they just have to take to fish meal heaven to get them out of the bay.
And we'll see if we can post this wonderful recipe for blue cat seafood hash on the WIPR website. And of course, you can get it in John Shields' book. We will have more with John Shields. We'll take your questions and comments, a different number than the pledge number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can drop us a tweet and catch us on Facebook Live. Thanks, Andy, and thanks again to everybody who has pledged so far in our fall membership campaign. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. If you just joined us, my guest is the celebrated Baltimore chef and author John Shields. His latest book is called The New Chesapeake Kitchen, and as we mentioned, if you make a pledge to become a member of WIPR while supplies last, and they are going fast, as one would expect, in addition to whatever thank you gift you may qualify for at your donation level, you will receive a copy of John's beautiful new book. And when you pledge for this book, you have to select, you have to make sure that you do select John Shields, The New Chesapeake Kitchen. John writes about how the culinary traditions of the past have influenced a new generation of watermen, farmers, artisans, and environmental stewards, and everybody committed to the vitality of the Chesapeake Bay and beyond. Our phone number, if you want to share your favorite Chesapeake recipes, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can drop us a tweet, and you can catch us on the WIPR Facebook page. So you mentioned earlier, John, that you have suggestions as to how to sort of stretch out the proteins that we can get from the bay.
Yeah.
Let's talk about crabs. Yeah. You mentioned that in the book that there are so many more people living in the Chesapeake Bay watershed than ever before, and it's having its effect on availability of stuff. So in recent decades, the amount of crab that folks are harvesting from the bay is dramatically decreased. You're not suggesting that we eliminate crab cakes.
No way.
Heaven forbid. you're not one of these pita types, right?
Yeah.
The ways that you approach making the most out of these precious resources.
Well, you know, there's a number of ways. And again, I look to the past. You know, my grandmother, after a crab feast, would pick all the leftover crab, and she would make one of our Maryland crab soups with full of vegetables. You know, we got them all at the farmer's market, right? Big pot with corn and with tomatoes and potatoes and lima beans. And so, again, we can do that, and we could transfer that into a stew. So just make it, put a little bit more barley in it. And there's a number of different places now that are doing grain, local grain. So we get some gorgeous local farro, and we make that at the bottom of the bowl, and then you put that red crab soup in all over top of it.
Thickens it right up,
and you have a whole meal. So, okay, so that 1 pound of crab that before would have fed three people as crab cakes is now going to probably feed 8 to 10 people as a meal like that.
Yeah.
And then my Aunt Bessie, she had one that she would take a bunch of bread and she would soak it and put eggs in it and all kinds of herbs and onions. And then she would mix it with the crab meat and she would bake it as a pudding. It turned out it was like a bread pudding. So Aunt Bessie's crab pudding is in the book as mm-hmm. well. And so, again, it's taking that 1 pound of crab meat, and instead of feeding three people, you're feeding six, eight, 10, 12.
Yeah, yeah. Is there in your, and I think the crab cakes at Gertrude's are terrific. We should mention, of course, Gertrude is your grandmother. It's named after
yes.
your grandmother, Gertie's. The crab cakes at the BMA are just terrific, and there are probably two dozen restaurants around here that claim to have the best crab cake in Maryland. What are the general precepts that you need to keep in mind as you're making a great crab cake? Because people do it a little bit differently, you know, from person to person. What are the general principles that you have to adhere to?
Well, I think number one is good crab meat. So obviously, you know, we're from the Chesapeake and we prefer Maryland or Chesapeake crab meat. That's what we consider to be the best. If you don't have that, then you can get crab meat from up and down the East Coast and into the Gulf. Also, very, very good product. So that's number one. Number two, you don't want to do too much to it. So generally, general rule is
keep it simple,
a little bit
right.
of something, put a little mayonnaise, an egg, and then some seasonings in it. Some people put lemon butter in it. Some people put Old Bay in it. Some people put a little bit of hot sauce and Tabasco sauce. And then also you don't want to put too much breading in it because obviously we've all driven across country. We got to Boise, Idaho. We went in there and it says Maryland crab cake. So it's like a car accident. You can't help yourself. You know it's not going to be good, but you get it. And so it's almost all filler.
I can't look away. That's
almost
right.
all filler.
Yeah.
So again, that's the rule. Just a little tiny bit just to hold the crab meat together. And I really think that if you have those, you know, those very simple things, you're going to have a wonderful, wonderful crab cake.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And, you know, it is funny how people do have these little, just teeny, you know, variations. Two decent, dear friends, Chicky Grayson and Amy Elias, both make wonderful crab cakes. We actually had a dinner one time where we had dueling crab cakes, and they each made a batch and didn't say whose was which, and we all ate them, and we voted and stuff. It was a lot of fun. But one thing you got to talk me into is oysters.
Yeah.
You're a big fan of oysters.
I love oysters.
And I just don't eat them. So yeah. What am I missing? You got to convert me here.
Well, I mean, maybe so do you not just like raw oysters? Have you tried fried oysters, like single fried oysters?
I haven't tried that. So my wife Linnell orders oysters every time we go
yeah.
to some place that seems to have good ones, you know.
Yeah.
And I just never she eats them raw.
Yeah.
I mean, I've just never done that. I mean, what's the I don't know why that is. It's a personal preference, I guess. But
yeah.
What are the things that I should be looking for good? Let's talk about raw oysters first.
Yeah.
What are the things I should be looking for when it comes to raw oysters?
Well, you want them to be nice, plump oysters. We get them, obviously, you know, from the Chesapeake. So you have wild and you have farm-raised, which is the farm-raised are just phenomenal as well. And they're available year-round. So pretty much, you know, and the further south the oyster comes from, the more salinity it has. And so they're a little bit saltier, a little mm-hmm. brinier. So people are really funny about that. Some people like a sweet, crisp oyster, which you would get closer up to our end of the bay. And some like are really into it has to be really salty and briny. So you need a little bit further. So you need to kind of know where the oysters are from. That is helpful. But for novices and people that, and a lot of people don't like raw oysters. I mean, you're not alone. Trust me.
Are there certain sauces that people always dip them in before
yeah,
they throw them in?
Yeah, they'll put a cocktail sauce on right. it or a minuet sauce, which is, you know, some vinegar, a very nice vinegar with shallots. And people who really don't like them, they pile a lot of cocktail sauce on it.
Disguise the flavor.
but really, I think, you know, if next time you come up and see me, I'm going to make you some single fried oysters that are
fried oysters, and that sounds pretty
like
good.
Like they're in half cornmeal, half flour with some seasonings in them, nice and crisp, I think you'll like them.
All right. All right. Well, that I have no doubt, actually, because you've never steered me wrong in the past. I want to talk about a recipe you have for hominy and gravy with turkey sausage patties. Right? Hominy is evidently a thing that your grandmother, Gertie, really, really loved.
She did. And, you know, in the turn of the century, not this one that we just turned, but the one before, hominy was like crazy king in Baltimore and in this whole area. They had carts that would go all around through the neighborhood selling already pre-cooked hominy. Hominy is the whole kernel of corn, and they wash it over and over again. They call it a reverse osmosis process. They use a little lye in it, and it whitens it up. And so you take those kernels and you soak them, and then you cook them. And then we often do them sort of like a mac and cheese. You get the kernels nice and tender, and then you make a little bit of a cream sauce with some local cheddar in there, and just fold the whole thing in. But it's really different than grits. Grits are made from that hominy. They're mm-hmm. ground down into a finer.
So grits starts with hominy.
It starts with hominy. Mm-hmm. But around here, we've always liked the whole kernel, and it's a completely different taste. And so you can make a cheesy thing out of it. I've even made custards out of it with sugar and cinnamon and made a dessert out of it. Hmm. And it was absolutely delicious.
John Shields, the new book is called The New Chesapeake Kitchen. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you want to chime in with a favorite recipe from the Chesapeake Bay or anywhere else, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet and catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. And again, if you make a pledge in this hour to WYPR to become a member, while supplies last, you will get a free copy of The New Chesapeake Kitchen. When it comes to grains, John, you're right about this in this new book. There are a lot of grains that have become sort of commercialized and hybridized, and they're not pure in the way that your grandmother was used to getting them back in the day.
Yeah. I mean, and it's not just unique to the Chesapeake, but it's happened all over the country, where most of the fields now are used for commodity crops, for corn, genetically modified corn, and soybeans that are used for animal feed, sometimes for ethanol, those kinds of things. And so we've lost a lot of the variety, the old heritage varieties that were grown all in different regions. Like, look at the names of, Meadow Mills, all these different mills. They weren't just manufacturing mills. They were all grain mills because, again, we grew the grain near to where we lived. We would process the grain, and then we would eat it. So there's a number of guys over on the Eastern Shore who are now starting to redo heritage grains. And it's really important, not only are they delicious and they oh my God, you can taste, you can taste the flavor in them. But what happens is they're usually doing it kind of in an organic manner, and they are rebuilding the soil. They're making it healthy again, because the commodity crops usually have a lot of pesticides and fertilizers in there, and it doesn't do the soil real good.
Yeah.
We don't have so much topsoil with that. So again, just by buying that kind of thing, we're helping to rebuild the soil. We're helping to rebuild the Chesapeake. And it ain't bad for your body either.
Yeah, sure. And one of the things that you make a point of mentioning in the book is that these wonderful farmers that we've gotten to know at the farmer's market, and I can certainly point to three or four of them, their kids started working for them when they were 8 or 9 years old, and now they're in college, or they're running the farm as adults. There is this wonderful tradition being passed on from generation to generation, and you actually see a city folk see it at the farmer's market. The folks who live near these farms, of course, have seen this and grown up with it all their lives. But there is the traditions are being passed down, and we can pass our traditions to the next generation as well when it comes to the way we cook, the techniques we use, the places that we source our food.
Absolutely, because we teach. My grandmother taught me a lot about food and about life and how that connected to food. And I think the way that we do with our children and our neighbors and show them, it really does it. It instills a way of life. And it's important.
Well, congratulations on this book, John. It's just beautiful. It's called The New Chesapeake Kitchen, and we look forward to talking about it many more times. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
John Shields, his new book, again, is called The New Chesapeake Kitchen. And by the way, all of the copies that we have are no longer have been spoken for. So folks who made pledges during this hour of midday are going to be the proud owners of this wonderful new book, The New Chesapeake Kitchen. John Shields, of course, the chef and owner at Gertrude's Restaurant at the Baltimore Museum of Art. He'll be at the Baltimore Book Festival on Saturday at the Food for Thought stage. So come by for cooking demos and all that kind of stuff. We've got information on our website, wipr.org/midday. On tomorrow's program, a conversation about political third parties. I'll be joined by Libertarian David Lasher, Green Party candidate Ian Schlockman, and Independent Neil Simon. That's coming up tomorrow. Coming up tonight, let me remind you that WIPR will broadcast the gubernatorial debate between Republican Larry Hogan and Democrat Ben Jealous. We want to thank The Diz for supplying lunch. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. They're open for lunch and dinner with breakfast on the weekends. They're on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. We also want to thank everybody who's made a pledge in this fall membership campaign. Andy Beanstock joins me once again to tell you just how easy and important it is to make that call or go online.
It is easy. Just go to WIPR.org.